My early banking career, 1954 to 1959. Commerzbank branch in my hometown Mülheim. In early January 1954, I put on my best suit and went to my appointment with the branch of Commerzbank in Mülheim. Director Wetzel interviewed me and reviewed my papers and report cards from schools. Then he told me that I would hear from them. A couple of weeks later, I received a letter from Director Wetzel advising that I had been accepted as an apprentice for the usual 3-year period. An apprentice agreement was attached, which I had to fill in, sign, and return. The process was not complete yet. I had to undergo a medical examination by a Commerzbank-appointed medical doctor, and, assuming that this examination did not uncover any problems, I was hired. Another couple of weeks later, I got the final confirmation that Commerzbank had hired me as an apprentice. I was happy, and my parents were very proud. Horst Jägler, handball star, and my foreign exchange teacher. RSV Mülheim was a very successful handball club. Led by Hermann Will and Heinz Menkhoff, they had won the German handball championship several times over their main competitors, Polizei Hamburg with Adam Otto Mitzak and H.C. Winterbeck Kiel with Hein Dollinger. Handball is played on a soccer field and resembles soccer except, surprise, surprise, the ball must be thrown, not kicked, into the goal. At the time, handball and field hockey reigned together as the second most popular sports in Germany, behind all overshadowing soccer. Today, handball is still quite popular in Europe, but it is mostly played indoors. The coach of RSV Mülheim was Paul Kosmala, who was at the time a godlike celebrity in Mülheim and in all of Germany. Like all coaches, then and now, Kosmala was always on the lookout for fresh young talent and Oser good players to strengthen his RSV team. He had identified Horst Jägler, a young, outstanding handball player in the East German town of Magdeburg, and convinced him to move to Mülheim to play handball for RSV. This was in the early 1950s, before the Berlin Wall was built, so there was no problem moving from the east to the west of Germany. Paul Kosmala was friendly with Dr. Karl Haas, the powerful and charismatic executive of the local Hugo Stinnes Bank. Dr. Haas provided a job for Jägler in his bank. Zit was part of the agreement to attract Jägler to come from Magdeburg to Mülheim, and Zit was how Jägler got paid.
Apprenticeship in Banking at Hugo Stinnes Bank. Soon after I contracted to join Commerzbank, my father proudly shared the good news with his baker friends in Mülheim. One of those friends was Uli Fassbender, who owned a big bakery right in the center of Mülheim. Instead of sharing my father's joy about the fact that I got an apprentice job with prestigious Commerzbank, he was unenthusiastic about it. "That is an old-fashioned, dusty bank," he said. "Somebody has to die or retire before anybody gets promoted there." Uli Fassbender went on to talk about his friend Dr. Haas from the Hugo Stinnes Bank. "They are a small but modern bank and make money like hay," he exclaimed. Fassbender went on to set up a dinner at his house, to which Dr. Haas with his wife and my parents were invited. The plan was to entice Dr. Haas to hire me as an apprentice at the Hugo Stinnes Bank. On the evening of the dinner, I sat at home in Stierum, waiting for a phone call requesting me to come to the Fassbender house and meet with Dr. Haas. When the phone rang, I took the tram for the 15-minute ride into the center of town. I was not yet 18 and did not have my driver's license. My parents had taken the car into town to the Fassbenders anyway. By the time I arrived at the Fassbender house, it was already after dinner. Dr. Haas, who was about 40 years old, had consumed a few glasses of wine and was in a jovial mood. After a while, he took me aside and interviewed me for a few minutes. When we rejoined the group, Dr. Haas told my parents, "I feel sorry for your son. He has been trained like a machine. He gave me perfect and enthusiastic answers to whatever question I asked him." Then, turning to me, he said, "Come to my office April 1st. You are hired." And that was it. The evening proceeded and ended in a most pleasant way, and we went home. We used Dr. Kalman's influence to cancel the agreement that I had already signed with Commerzbank and waited for some confirming communication from Dr. Haas. It was now already the end of February, weeks after that evening at the Fassbender house. We worried. What if Dr. Haas was already slightly drunk and had forgotten that he hired me? Finally, my father got his friend Uli Fassbender to follow up with Dr. Haas. I told him that he was hired and should come to my office April 1st. "Was that not clear enough?" was the reply. So that was that. What a difference in the hiring process between Commerzbank and Hugo Stinnes Bank.
I want to summarize how I got the job as an apprentice at Hugo Stinnes Bank. Without my performance in tennis, Kahlenberg Club president Dr. Kalmund would never have known me. He gave me the idea to become a banker and introduced me to Commerzbank, which otherwise would never have talked to me, would not even have known me. My father's baker friend Uli Fassbender led to the contact with Dr. Haas of Hugo Stinnes Bank, whom I impressed with solid knowledge about what I had learned at the higher trade school. Thursday, April 1st, 1954, was my first day at Hugo Stinnes Bank. I had put on my best outfit, a light grey blazer and royal blue trousers. I was tall and suntanned and looked like a star, which I actually was on the tennis courts. When my mother saw me, she made me change into an older suit that I had actually outgrown a bit. She said, "It could be that your first boss is a little man who does not look that good. When he sees you in that super outfit, he will immediately have negative feelings about you." And mother was right again. My first boss, Dr. Helfer, was indeed a little unimpressive guy, but he turned out to be quite nice to me. My first job was in the payment division, where I had to pay bills that our customers sent to us. I did that for about 3 months, and then something very special happened.
Joining the foreign exchange department at Hugo Stinnes Bank, August 1954, age 18, handball star Horst Jägler had joined Stinnes Bank a couple of years earlier. His designated job was to buy foreign currencies that Dr. Haas and other executives needed when they traveled outside of Germany to destinations like Brussels, Amsterdam, or Paris. They needed Belgian francs, Dutch guilders, and French francs to pay their bills with cash while traveling, because the credit card had not yet been invented, and the euro was not yet the common currency for all of Europe. At Stinnes, they called this foreign exchange trading. The actual professional term for this activity is trading foreign money, which involves trading the actual physical paper bills of the various currencies. Jägler not only was a good handball player, but he also had a Master's of Business degree and was quite smart. A few months after he had been hired into Stinnes Bank, he began to trade real foreign exchange.
The amounts in the business were much larger, and the various foreign currency amounts bought and sold were received and paid as telegraphic transfers for value 2 business days after the trade was done. Nobody had asked Jaegler to do this business. He just did it, and nobody asked any questions. He was what one calls a self-starter, someone who sees an opportunity and just goes ahead and does it. The story of Horst Jaegler is another example of how excellence in a sport can open doors of opportunity, which other people often refer to as luck. Yes, Horst Jaegler was lucky that the sport of handball brought him to West Germany, Mülheim, and the Hugo Stinnes Bank. However, it was his ingenuity, creativity, and drive for excellence combined with hard work that allowed him to progress from the almost clerical job of buying foreign banknotes for the executives at Stinnes to becoming one of the most highly paid professional foreign exchange traders in Germany and Europe. Jaegler's foreign exchange business was pure speculation. He just followed his intelligence and instincts, buying low and selling high. Every day he bought and sold the same amounts and currencies, so that he was always square, that is, was out a risk position in the evening when he went home. In this way, he never tied up any marks. In other words, this business did not require any actual cash, even though his daily turnover was many millions. That is how he made a ton of money. Money like hay, as Uli Fassbender said.
It is important to me that readers understand in principle the preceding paragraph. To facilitate that understanding, I came up with an analogy in which apples plays a role of foreign currencies. At 5 a.m., a woman drives to the central wholesale produce market and buys 100 pounds of apples at $2 per pound, for a total of $200. Because she is friendly with the wholesaler and he trusts her, he permits her to bring him the $200 later in the afternoon. After she purchases the apples, the woman drives to town where market day is opening at 6:30 a.m. The woman sells all her 100 pounds of apples to her customers for $3 per pound, or a total of $300. As a result, she no longer has a risk position in apples. She has sold exactly as many apples as she bought from the wholesaler in the morning. Traders say in professional language that her position is square. However, the dollar equivalents of her apple purchases and sales are not the same. She is not square in dollars. The difference of $1 per pound, or a total of $100, is her profit after she pays the wholesaler $200. The important point is that she traded in apples, made a profit of $100, and did not use any of her own cash. Jaegler's business was done on the phone. The trading partners were banks all over Europe. The business was fast and conducted in foreign languages, mostly English and some French. It also involved many numbers. Jaegler's only assistant was Herr Schleicher, who got seriously sick in August. Jaegler needed a new assistant for his foreign exchange business, which at the time, and to this day, was rather exotic and little understood. During my 3 months in Stinnes Bank, I had made enough of an impression that Dr. Helfer, the little man who was my first boss, selected me to be Jaegler's assistant. Voila! I had joined the foreign exchange department. Working for Jaegler in the Stinnes foreign exchange room. All foreign exchange trades had to be confirmed in writing.
I typed up our confirmation, which had to be signed by Jaegler, and mailed to the bank with which we had done the trade. That bank also sent a confirmation to us. I had to compare their incoming confirmation with a copy of our outgoing confirmation to make sure that all details of the trade were the same. For all currencies sold, I had to prepare payment orders. These orders were sent to the bank, there we had the money, correspondent bank, asking them to debit our account and pay the money to the bank to which we had sold that amount of currency. Stinnes was a very small bank and really did not have that much money. In a bank, money is particularly needed over the end of the month. Occasionally, it happened that we had to pay an amount of money on the last day of the month, but we did not have it. In these situations, Jaegler would simply not sign the payment order. When I reminded him that we had to pay, he would simply say that we will pay one day later, after the end of the month. When the bank that should have received the money called and complained, I had to say, "Sorry, we forgot. Please charge us one day interest for the late payment." This was a very bad practice, but I was only 18, and Jort, if superstar Jaegler says so, it is probably okay.
Speculative foreign exchange, FX trading at Stinnes. Jaegler also entered into forward FX contracts. This is an agreement in which two counterparties agree to exchange two currencies, buy one and sell the other one, for a forward delivery date 1 or 3 months in the future. At that time, in 1954, European currencies were traded against each other, but their spot FX rate, that is, for delivery 2 business days later, could not rise or fall beyond intervention points established by the European central banks, as per the International Bretton Woods Agreement. In the case of the pound/DM rate, this fluctuation range for the spot FX rate was approximately between DM 11.75 and 11.77 per pound. However, the forward FX rate could be traded outside this range. The British pound was a weak currency and expected to decline in value. The pound interest rate was much higher than the interest rate for the DM. As a result, the 3-month forward FX rate for the pound/DM might have been DM 11.72 or 0.03 below the lower intervention spot rate of DM 11.75. In such a situation, Jaegler's trading strategy was to buy pounds for delivery 3 months forward at DM 11.72. In 3 months, he could sell the pounds in the spot market at the minimum rate of DM 11.75. Of course, the risk was that during those 3 months, the pound would devalue, or the DM would revalue, resulting in a much lower spot FX rate for the pound, such as possibly DM 10.50. Jaegler did not worry about those jings, or he might not even have understood that at the time. I certainly did not. Jaegler vacations leaving me in charge, still age 18. A couple of months after I had joined Jaegler's FX department, he went on vacation for 2 weeks and left me running the show. Jaegler reported to Dr. Haas, so in his absence, I reported directly to Dr. Haas. During that time, I looked at our forward FX positions and just for fun, asked other banks at what prices we might be able to liquidate those positions. For example, if we had bought 3-month forward pounds 2 months ago at DM 11.72, the maturity of those pounds was now only 1 month away. In such a case, I might have been able to sell/liquidate that position at DM 11.74 for a DM 0.02 per pound profit, or
DM2000 on a £100,000 position. Remember, this was 1954, then DM2000 was probably equivalent to US$50,000 today. I brought these forward positions, including the size of the unrealized profits, to the attention of Dr. Haas. As it turned out, he had no idea that those positions existed. He asked me to sell out those positions and realize the profits. More hay.
Losing control and creating chaos. The day-to-day operations of the FX department required more than just selling out already existing forward positions. I did not have the ability to run the FX room and lost complete control over what was going on. The day came when Dr. Haas called me to his office and questioned me about what was happening in my FX room. He sat behind his desk, a table without any drawers, just the table and four legs. I stood in front of that desk. He asked me many questions, and I could not answer any of them. It was a very hot day, and I was understandably nervous. Dr. Haas began to lift the table a little and banged it down on the floor in rhythm with each word of his question to me. "You must be able to tell me what you did." I fainted. When I woke up again, I sat in Dr. Haas's chair behind the desk, and Dr. Haas was standing in front of me. In the end, Dr. Haas said that the disaster was his fault, because he should not have put a greenhorn like me in charge of the FX room. And I think he was right. For me, the full thing was still a great learning experience. Lessons learned at an early age. Importance of mental arithmetic / numeracy and precise language. At this point in my life, I realized some important concepts. One is that a good education is the foundation of a good life. It is absolutely important to be outstanding in school. I did not have much of a scholastic / academic education, but whatever was offered to me, I absorbed nearly 100%. There are two things which helped me enormously. Mental arithmetic, that is, multiplying numbers between 1 and 19 in my head at lightning speed. So many other calculations are based on that. This ability, combined with a good memory, can be applied to very many practical life situations. Logical thinking and the ability to express logical thoughts clearly, the way they are generated in my head. A precondition for the ability to express oneself clearly is to first exactly understand whatever point or issue one is discussing. I often do not quite understand what people are saying. Then I follow up with a question. It often turns out that they themselves do not really clearly understand the issue they are discussing. No wonder then that they was not able to express the point clearly. I found that this habit of asking clarifying questions is not helpful in social settings, where people do not wish to be put on the spot. However, I found this practice to be very helpful in business, where insisting on clarification and precise understanding has helped me to come up with many new and creative thoughts and practices. I remember that when my mother talked about unlikely things that had happened, and how my mother was disadvantaged versus her brother, that I said, "They could not have done that to me." Often I thought that people did not really understand what was happening to them, and failed to ask questions. They only saw that they got the poorer end of the bargain and did not understand why or how to remedy the situation. This was the beginning of my style. To understand a situation precisely and then insist that the proper action is taken.
I continued my apprenticeship at Stinnes Bank, which included one day per week of schooling at the local trade school. There I learned the theory behind the practices I learned on the job. This is part of the famous German dual education system. After about 4 months in Jägler's FX room, the bank circulated me throughout all the departments, as called for by the apprenticeship agreement. I learned the nuts and bolts of banking, including accounting, balance sheet management, securities, letters of credit, collections, mortgages, etc.
In each of those departments, I got to know different people, some of whom became friends. I remember in particular Mrs. Marga Bush, who was in charge of letters of credits and collections. She was about 7 years older, and I learned many things from her and her husband. I returned to the FX department early in 1956. Jägler had returned to Margdeburg in East Germany. The department had grown, and Heinz Zöller was in charge. His assistant was Wolfgang Koch, nicknamed Cocky. Tennis was still important, but it began to occupy a slightly lesser place in my life. I won the Kahlenberg Club Singles Championship a couple of times and helped to put the maiden team into the highest class. However, star coach Pohman left Kahlenberg and Dr. Kalmund was aging and could not play much singles anymore. The Kahlenberg maiden team could not survive in the highest maiden class against the much stronger clubs playing there. Most importantly, I turned 19 years old and lost my junior status in tennis. I was no longer eligible for junior tournaments, including the Henner Henkel team, with which I won the German team championships. I reactivated my contacts in Gut Weiss Tennis Club in Sterum. They forgave me, and I played tennis in both clubs, Kahlenberg and Gut Weiss, including the maiden games again for Gut Weiss. In February 1956, my father died of cancer. He was sick for only a brief period of time. The cancer was so advanced that doctors could not save him. My mother, age 48 at the time, grieved over the loss of the love of her life. She wrote on the tombstone, "Ich hatte einen Kameraden, einen besseren findest du nicht." I had a comrade. You cannot find a better one. My father's assistant ran the bakery for several months. Finally, my mother rented both the bakery and the store to Mr. and Mrs. Heckel. This was the first time in my mother's life that she did not have any business responsibilities. She was free to do whatever she wanted to. After my father's death, Dr. Haas at Stinnes consoled me. "Anything you would have discussed with your father, you may discuss with me," he said. Certified banker in 1956. Passed exam with excellence. At the conclusion of the banking apprenticeship, there were formal written and oral examinations. I had already completed the written examination. For the oral test, there were about 20 apprentices to be examined by the director of the trade school that I had attended one day per week during the apprenticeship. There also was an examination board consisting of 5 senior people from various banks in the region. The director explained the format of the examination. He would state a topic, and the candidates, could raise our hand if we wanted to talk for 10 minutes about that particular topic. He would mention all topics, and once all candidates had selected a topic, the presentations would begin. The first topic offered by the director was mortgages and liens on real estate. I was familiar with that topic and raised my hand. I thought, who knows what all the exotic topics might come up? So I will take this one. After a few more topics had been assigned, the director mentioned the topic foreign exchange markets. Of course,
I would have loved to talk about that, but I already had my topic and could not change it. An apprentice from a savings bank got the topic about FX markets. Then something surprising happened. The five bankers representing the examination board had been sitting there sipping coffee and saying nozing. However, now one of them, Dr. Dirtman from the National Bank in Essen, said, "I propose that we switch topics. The candidate from the savings bank might prefer to talk about mortgages on real estate, and Mr. Riel from the more international Stinnes Bank might want to talk about foreign exchange." The director in charge of the examinations was glad that any member of the examination board had said anything at all, and immediately agreed with that proposal. Obviously, I liked it a lot. When all topics had been assigned, I volunteered to go first to talk about foreign exchange. At that time, I was already a foreign exchange trader and dazzled the examiners with my presentation, which probably went way over their heads. I passed the examination with honors. Below is the formal certificate, of which I am very proud. Dr. Haas was also pleased. As an apprentice, I had been paid what was called education support, Erziehungs by Hilfe, of 25 marks per month, equivalent of $6. Dr. Haas knew that I was a recognized FX trader known in the European market. Therefore, he established my first salary as a certified banker at 400 marks per month. At the time, an entire family could live on that kind of money. I was 20 years old.
Foreign exchange trading at Stinnes Bank, possibly best in the world. When I returned to the FX trading room in early 1956, I noticed that it had changed dramatically since the Jägele days in 1954. The entire FX market had grown, and trading at Stinnes had become very sophisticated. In fact, the Stinnes traders, including me, were viewed as leaders in Europe. This reputation resulted from our trading skill, and also because the name Hugo Stinnes was viewed as first class in the world. Mr. Hugo Stinnes had amassed a tremendous industrial empire at the beginning of the 1900s. He did all of this with borrowed money. In the early 1920s, there was enormous inflation in Germany. On November 16, 1923, there was a big devaluation of the Reichsmark, then 12 zeros were cut from prices to create the new Rentenmark. However, before this big devaluation, Mr. Hugo Stinnes paid back all of his debt with what had become worthless Reichsmarks. As a result, he owned his industrial empire free and clear of all debt and had become one of the wealthiest people in Germany. At the end of the Second World War, in 1945, the Allies, Americans, English, and French, expropriated most of that empire. Mr. Hugo Stinnes Jr., his brother Otto Stinnes, and their mother Claire Hugo Stinnes Wagenknecht had a little money left with which they founded the Hugo Stinnes O, often a Handelsgesellschaft, a private trading company. The finance department of that company obtained a banking license and called itself Hugo Stinnes Bank. It is obvious that the entire company, and certainly the Hugo Stinnes Bank, were extremely undercapitalized. However, the world did not understand all of that in the early 1950s after the war. They only heard the name Hugo Stinnes and remembered the pre-war glory of that name. They did not worry about what is known today as counterparty credit risk when they traded with us. The fact that at the time, we were probably the smartest and fastest FX traders further supported that wonderful image.
The biggest banks in Europe did not worry about our creditworthiness and happily traded with us. One reason why FX traders at Stinnes had to be so smart was that we did not have any customer business. Other banks had customers who, for example, would import wine from France and had to pay for that wine in French francs. Those importers sold the wine in Germany for marks and had to convert those marks into French francs to pay for the imported wine. They did this conversion of marks into French francs with a German bank, which would charge a profit spread or commission for that transaction. We did not have any such customers. We simply speculated in the market, buying and selling based on our gut feeling and our interpretation of how the economic and political news might impact FX rates. We said of ourselves that we were like tigers in the jungle. Every morning we knew that we would eat, but we did not know what we would eat. All international telephone calls from Germany to London, Paris, Zurich, etc. had to go through an operator, Fräulein vom Amt. The alternative was the telex machine, which was something like a two-way typewriter. We did not have electric calculators yet. Instead, we had a mechanical machine called Facet. It had a pinwheel mechanism with key setting that could multiply a 10-digit number by an 8-digit number and give a 13-digit answer. We were also one of the very few banks in Europe / the world that understood the relationship between interest rate differentials and the premiums and discounts in the forward FX market. This knowledge, combined with our speed, enthusiasm, and hunger for profit, made us at the time, quite possibly, from a technical viewpoint, the best foreign exchange traders in the world.
New Year's Eve, 1956. Meeting first wife, Karin Buss, age 20. I celebrated New Year's Eve, 1956, with a group of friends from Stinnes at the Mülheim Stadthalle, under the management of Paul Neu, which was the number one place to go at the time. We had already welcomed the new year, and the time was about half hour after midnight. I ran into a young lady and asked her to dance. It was Karin Buss. It turned out that she was a member of Kahlenberg Tennis Club and knew me because I was the club champion at the time. We hit it off well and started dating. Karin worked in the office of her father's Volkswagen dealership and repair shop. Otto Buss was a highly respected name in Mülheim and beyond. I met Karin's parents, and she came to Stierum and met my mother. It began to be a well-rounded, good relationship. As I had reactivated my relationship with Gut Weiss Tennis Club, I introduced Karin also to that club. We both played tennis in both clubs. Karin also attended the parties given by my cousin Renata. Karin went with my mother and me to annual meetings of the shareholders of major corporations. Zro Herbert Vogt at Dresdner Bank, my initial tennis mentor, we bought so-called Fressaktien, a small amount of shares in these corporations, which entitled us to attend. The management of those corporations dished out unbelievably good food and wines to keep the shareholders happy and distract them from what was going on in the company. My mother often met interesting gentlemen at those events, and we all had a good time. I frequently dined out with Karin and her parents. I remember New Year's Eves 1957, 1958, and 1959 spent at Paul Neu's new hotel and restaurant in the center of Mülheim. Karin's father, Hermann Buss, and Paul Neu had been classmates in school, so that we always got extra good service in Paul's restaurants. At midnight on New Year's Eve, there came an actual chimney sweeper with a living, suckling pig on his arm into the restaurant as a good luck charm for everyone. Photos were taken, and a good time was had by all.
Training in Paris for 2 months with Crédit Lyonnais, 1958. Dr. Haas decided that the Stinnes FX trading room needed some international training. Therefore, he arranged for me to spend 2 months, from mid-March to mid-May 1958, in Paris as a stagiaire, or trainee, with Crédit Lyonnais, which at the time was the largest bank in France. The time was carefully chosen. The training was to end in mid-May. My birthday is May 11th, Karen's birthday is May 14th, and Karen and I had decided to get engaged May 15th in Paris. My mother, Karen's parents, as well as Dr. Haas and his wife, were to come to Paris and celebrate with us. The wedding was planned for the following year, in April 1959. Dr. Haas knew how to party. The engagement party ended with a visit to the famous Paris nightclub Crazy Horse on the Champs-Élysées, featuring the famous Kessler twins, who were actually German girls. Crédit Lyonnais was located in the heart of Paris, on Boulevard des Italiens, between Place de l'Opéra and the Opéra Comique. Stinnes had booked me into a tiny hotel called Hôtel de l'Opéra Comique at 4 Rue d'Amboise, just around the corner from the bank. Stinnes paid for the hotel, including breakfast. In addition, they gave me the equivalent of $10 per day. Immediately, I made breakfast my main meal of the day. The rest of the money I spent at so-called bars to invite someone for a demi, a small beer, so they had to talk to me in French. Learning to speak French. At the bank, nobody spoke English or German. I was asked to sit next to the lady operating the telex, Mademoiselle Danielle. She was not very busy and had lots of time to talk to me. I spent the morning in school learning French at the Alliance Française. There were about 25 students from some 10 different countries. Nosing was translated. Students simply had to somehow learn and absorb par pour, which means zruff the skin. At midday, I would go to the Bourse, the Paris Exchange, where the principal traders of all Paris banks met to trade face to face. They were standing around La Colbée, the basket, and yelling FX rates at each other. In U.S. futures trading, this is known as the open outcry system. They closed transactions by saying either je prends, which means I buy, or j'ai, which means I sell. Behind the corbeille, each bank had a phone booth staffed for the more junior trader, who kept them connected to the outside world. For the first 2 weeks, I basically could not say anything in French. When I wanted to say a sentence with 6 words to Mademoiselle Danielle, I had to look up half the words in the dictionary. Then, after about 2 weeks, I woke up one morning and I was able to speak French. Of course, it was the most basic French you can imagine, but I was able to communicate. Once I could speak a little, my ability quickly expanded. That was the time when I began to drink beer with perfect strangers to practice my French. It worked like this. There are many outdoor bars, including the famous Café de la Paix around the Place de l'Opéra. When I saw a man sitting alone at the counter, I would just sit next to him, strike up a conversation, and offer to buy a beer for him. Almost all the time he would accept, and then he had to talk to me. After another week or two, I could communicate about basically any subject. Of course, with limited vocabulary and terrible grammar. But it worked, and my French got better every day. The people at the bank and at the Bourse were surprisingly friendly. After all, this was only 13 years after the terrible Hitler war had ended. There must have been many whose friends or family had suffered or were killed by Nazi Germans. One French trader at the Bourse always called me Rittmeister von Arschloch, which translates into Riding Master of Asshole. Everybody, including me, laughed about it, and there were no bad feelings.
Through the Daily Bourse, I got to know all the important FX traders in Paris.
without spending any money on lunches or dinners. Some of them invited me to dinner, and we became friends. At a time when most trading was done on the phone, those personal contacts, relationships, and friendships were extremely important and valuable. There were a few traders with whom I developed a particularly close relationship. One of them was Mr. Sperry from the Paris branch of Turkish Bank Ottoman. He had grown up in Alsace and also spoke German. I spent a lot of time with him in the evening, walking through Paris and speaking French almost all the time. He was very helpful because I could ask him to translate special technical terms for me. For example, I learned from him the French version of "for accounting technical reasons," which is in French "pour des raisons techniques de la comptabilisation," or in German "aus buchungstechnischen Gründen." The head of foreign exchange, directeur, at Crédit Lyonnais was Maurice Plaquet. At the time, he was around 60 years old and one of the most senior FX traders in Europe. Once I could speak a little French, I had almost daily contact with this illustrious man. Only 3 years prior, he had created the Forex Club, which was later called the Association Cambiste Internationale, ACI. The slogan of the International Forex Club was, "Once a dealer, always a dealer." And for me, that turned out to be true throughout my life. Quote from the internet. The European foreign exchange market reopened 10 years after World War II. In this context, British and French traders took the opportunity to form an association whose objective is to represent the market community. June 29, 1955. Maurice Plaquet from the French Forex Club and Roy Bridge from the London Forex Club organized an inaugural Forex Club dinner in Paris. 1955 to 1957, 13 countries joined: USA, Canada, and 11 European countries, including Germany. May 11, 1957, First International Congress of ACI, Association Cambiste Internationale, it was in Paris, and worked with Maurice Plaquet in 1958, only 3 years after the Forex Club had been founded. I joined the German Forex Club in 1958 and attended the German National Meeting in Frankfurt. In 1959, I also attended the second International Congress held in London. At that time, I saw the musical My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews on stage at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. The greatest value of the Forex Club was to promote personal, face-to-face meetings of people who almost daily spoke on the phone to close foreign exchange transactions. Work at Stinnes FX Room after returning from Paris. Major event in FX market, December 29, 1958. In the second half of 1958, the Stinnes FX Room continued to grow and make money out of thin air, that is, out of nosing. We had no customers. My contribution was to deal with about 10 banks in Paris, with whom we had not traded before, and whom I had gotten to know during my 2 months there. I was the only one able to trade with them because I was the only one who could speak French. Those French banks spoke only limited English or German, and, more importantly, the French did not want to speak German or English.
On Saturday morning, December 27, 1958, I sat at my desk in the Stinnes dealing room, reading the newspaper. I saw the headlines that caught my attention. Surprise visit of German finance minister to Paris, making a big profit from devaluation of French franc. During past years, the French franc always had been weak,
and the German mark had been relatively strong. As a result, the French franc had always been at or near the spot trading lower intervention point of the European central banks, including the German Bundesbank, that is. Almost every weekend, the French franc was a candidate for devaluation. There was a voice in me saying that the French would devalue their franc versus the German mark on this weekend, and, as a result, the French franc would move substantially lower than where it was at this time on Saturday morning. So I picked up the phone and found another bank willing to trade on this usually very quiet day. I sold francs against marks for the standard spot value date, which was two business days later, i.e. Tuesday, December 30. I was senior enough to do this without asking anybody else in the dealing room. As a result, my Stinnes Bank was now short French francs against marks. Over that weekend, two major zings happened. The first was that the French franc devalued by 17%. The size of my position was equivalent to $1 million, so that I netted a profit equivalent to $170,000, which at the time was a very large amount of money. However, there was one problem. The French Central Bank told the French banks that foreign banks, such as the German Stinnes Bank, were not allowed to overdraw their French franc-denominated accounts. That was a problem for me and my Stinnes Bank. I had sold the francs on Saturday for value Tuesday. It was now Monday, and the standard spot value date was Wednesday. If I bought back my speculative short position in francs for value Wednesday, I would be overdrawn in my account for one day from Tuesday until Wednesday. The penalty for such an overdraft was 20% flat. That is larger than my speculative profit from the devaluation of 17%. That was how the French Central Bank wanted to penalize guys like me who had speculated against their currency. On that Monday morning, December 29th, 1958, the atmosphere in the Stinnes dealing room was near the boiling point. Dr. Haas and the other traders watched me calling one of my Paris friends after another, trying to borrow francs from Tuesday until Wednesday in an effort to save our $170,000 equivalent profit. I was the only one speaking French, and the only one who had personal contacts with the French traders. It was also Dr. Haas's birthday on that day. Not enough drama? His wife was in labor with their first child, and doctors had vaunted that there were complications that could endanger the life of mother and child. And then, within a 10-minute period, all problems were solved. My friend Spurry from Bank Ottoman, with whom I had spent so many nights walking rough Paris earlier that year, lent me the francs at 10% per annum, which was nothing compared to the 20% flat penalty rate the central bank would have charged. This secured the $170,000 profit. Also, Mrs. Haas gave birth to a perfectly healthy child. There was champagne on Dr. Haas's account for all.
The other major thing was that all European currencies, including the German mark, became convertible to US dollars, Canadian dollars, and Swiss francs. Up to that point, those three currencies were only freely convertible against each other. The other European countries could only trade their currencies amongst themselves, like junk against junk, but not against the other three convertible currencies. This change meant that as of the end of December 1958,
the Stinnes traders were now allowed to trade German marks against US dollars, which was not possible before that date. As we will see, this ability to trade US dollars against marks would play a major role very soon in my life. 2 days later, on Wednesday, December 31st, 1958, I received my first bonus from Dr. Haas. He called me out of the dealing room into the hallway, where we were alone. He reached into the pocket of his trousers and pulled out a handful of 100 mark bills. He gave the money to me and said, "You did well last year. Congratulations. Don't screw yourself to death." Then he walked away. This was the office climate at the Stinnes Bank. Rough language, no receipts for payments. When I counted the money, it turned out to be more than 800 marks, equivalent to about $200, which was my monthly salary at that time. Training in New York for 2 months at Citibank in August 1959. On a day in May 1959, I came back from lunch at home at 10 Leineweberstrasse, which was only a few hundred yards away from the Stinnes office. I was dressed in tennis clothes because I wanted to play tennis immediately after office hours. One of my fellow traders told me that Mr. Otto Stinnes, the owner of the bank, was eager to see me. I had never talked to Mr. Stinnes before, and at first did not believe this. However, when I called Mr. Stinnes's office, his secretary said, "Yes, Mr. Reel, please come to our office. Mr. Stinnes wants to speak to you." So I went to his office in my tennis attire and was very nervous. Mr. Stinnes sat there with Dr. Haas and Mr. Wilhelm Unger, who was in charge of the entire bank and, as such, was Dr. Haas's boss. Dr. Haas asked, "Mr. Reel, would you and your wife be prepared to go for 2 months in August to New York and train at Citibank?" I took a deep breath, thought for about 5 seconds, and said, "Yes." Then Dr. Haas asked the other two gentlemen, "Shall we decide now or wait?" They wanted to wait, and Dr. Haas told me to go back to my dealing room and wait for further instructions. The following events led up to this story. Mr. Wolfgang Koch, Cocky, the deputy chief FX trader, had been scheduled to go with his wife for 2 months to Citibank, New York. Mr. Stinnes and Dr. Haas felt that, since we were now able to trade German marks against dollars, somebody should go to New York, get to know the New York market, and represent the Stinnes Company in the U.S. Cocky and I were both deputies to chief trader Heinz Zöller, but Stinnes had chosen Cocky because he was 10 years older. Besides that, I had been in Paris, so it was Cocky's turn to go to New York.
It turned out that Cocky had borrowed money from his fellow traders and other employees at Stinnes and spent it all drinking and having fun with the ladies. When people wanted their money back, he did not have it. People wanted to get married and needed the money to pay for their first apartment, furniture, etc. And Cocky could not pay. So people finally went to their bosses and ultimately to Mr. Stinnes. Mr. Stinnes was very upset with Cocky's behavior and decided that this kind of person should not be the first one to represent him in America after the war. On the other side, all details had been cleared and discussed with Citibank, and somebody had to go so that Stinnes would not lose face with Citibank. Against that background, I was the logical next choice. 2 week voyage with Stinnes. Owned freighter, from German port Bremen to Newark, New Jersey, near New York. On Saturday, August 1st, 1959, Karin and I left the German port city of Bremen for the USA on a Stinnes-owned freighter with about 900 Volkswagen Beetles on board. The ship had 6 more passengers for a total of 8. We had our meals and otherwise socialized with about 4 officers of the ship, including the captain. We did not see any land for almost 2 weeks, and all of us became pretty good friends. The main activities included eating and drinking, as well as playing cards and chess. In the early morning of Thursday, August 13th, we were told to look out for land, and indeed, that was what we saw. The real highlight after the initial sighting of land was to see the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. I was 23 years old. I had a little money in my pocket, spoke English, and knew there were no enemies or unfriendly people expecting us. I also had an address in New York City, where I knew we were welcome to stay. When I saw the Statue of Liberty, I thought of the millions of immigrants who had passed through nearby Ellis Island without any of those comfort-producing advantages Karin and I had. It was quite a moment that I will never forget. Once we were on land, we took a taxi to an area called Riverdale in the Bronx, one of the 5 boroughs of New York City. The house in which Stinnes had rented a room, bath, and kitchen for us was about a 20-minute walk from the most northern stop of the New York subway, 242nd Street Station. The house had air conditioning, which I had never experienced before. However, there was no air conditioning on the top floor below the roof, which is where our little apartment was. And this, in August in New York, when temperature and humidity are in the 90s, 33 degrees Celsius. The lady who owns the house had good advice. Take all your clothes off and lie still on the bed. Your body temperature of 98 degrees, 37 Celsius, is higher than the temperature in the room, so you will cool down. During the next 2 days, Friday and Saturday, Karin and I just relaxed and got used to the new environment. After all, we were now in New York in the USA. Assuring on-time arrival at Citibank office on Monday morning. Special 15-mile trip on Sunday to Wall Street area. My marching orders from Stinnes were to report on Monday, August 17th at 8:30 a.m. to Mr. Eddie Rakus at Citibank, located at 20 Exchange Place in the Wall Street area. This is 15 miles, 24 kilometers, away from where we were in Riverdale. I wanted to make sure that I would not be late reporting to work on Monday morning, so Karin and I decided to take a quick trip to 20 Exchange Place in Manhattan. I wanted to know exactly where it was located. We got on the subway and headed south towards Wall Street. When we approached Times Square, it appeared on the subway map that we were already quite close to Wall Street. So we got off the subway to take a look at Times Square, the Great White Way, and then walk the rest of what we thought was a short way to Wall Street. Little did we know that it was still some 6 miles, 10 kilometers, from Times Square to Wall Street. But we made it, exhausted and drenched with sweat from the heat.
On that Sunday afternoon, I went to the reception desk of the 20 Exchange Place building and confirmed that indeed Mr. Edwin Rakus had an office in that building. I consider this a very important point. I had eliminated the possibility of getting lost in the jungle of Manhattan's financial district, Wall Street. After all, this was my first time in that area. If I had been late on that next day, Monday morning, starting sentences that begin with "but" and explaining that I did not know this and that, it might have sounded understandable. However, the German in me and the absolute desire to be on time and not be late made me take this extra precaution,
and assure that I would get to Mr. Riker's office on time. There is only one way to be on time, and that is to be early. Punctuality is important. Working in Mr. Riker's FX room at Citibank, New York, Edwin Eddie Riker was one of only about 50 vice presidents Citibank had at that time. He was 51 years old, and because his parents had been born in Germany, Eddie spoke a little German. He was responsible for all foreign exchange, FX, including the FX departments in the approximately 70 countries around the world where Citibank had branches. Eddie had joined the Citibank cable department in 1923, when he was 15 years old and straight out of high school wearing shorts. The Citibank New York FX department had its own cable department. Sometimes cables intended for the FX cable department were inadvertently sent to the general cable department. In such cases, young Eddie had to carry those messages from the general cable department to the FX cable department. He liked the livelier, international and electric atmosphere of the FX cable department much better, and asked to be transferred as a messenger boy from the general cable department to the FX cable department. From that beginning, he rose over 35 years to his recent position as VP and global head of all FX in Citibank worldwide. Eddie was very authoritative and appeared almost unfriendly. Nobody would talk to him unless Eddie asked a question. He was the boss, and nobody could do anything without asking him first. The entire department was quite large and had about 40 employees. Most of them were in supporting or clerical accounting-type positions. Periodically, it would happen that Eddie needed to replenish marks in his correspondent bank account with Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt. In such cases, he would ask one of his traders, George de Luna, with whom I later became good friends, "George, get Deutsche on the telex machine and ask them their rate for dollars against marks."
At that time, it took a few minutes for George to establish the connection and get the FX rate from Deutsche, at which time he would tell Mr. Rikers the rate quoted by Deutsche Bank. That rate at the time was somewhere around DM 4.1720 for $1, just slightly above the lower intervention slash support point of 4.1700. Mr. Rikers could not understand that rate because it was a quotation in German terms, that is, how many marks for $1. Mr. Rikers was in the USA and needed the quotation in American terms, that is, how many dollars for one mark. In order to convert the German rate of 4.1720 into the equivalent American FX rate, one had to calculate the reciprocal rate of 4.1720. For example, 1 divided by 4.1720, which 0.239693. This American rate of $0.239693 equal to 1 mark was understandable for Eddie Rikers. It would allow him to decide whether he liked it or not, and whether he would buy marks at that rate. The process worked like this. After George told Mr. Rikers the German rate of 4.1720, Mr. Rikers would always say, "Put that into the one," which meant divide 1 by 4.1720. At that point, George would walk the approximately 15 yards to the only calculator in that FX department and perform the calculation as Eddie Rikers had requested. All of that took probably 90 seconds, after which period George would announce the result to Mr. Rikers. Creative Calculation Act to get Mr. Rikers's attention. I really had nothing to do in that FX department, except to listen in on the phone conversations of the OSA traders. However, I had noticed the process of converting German FX rates into American FX rates,
and concluded that there was a way to improve that procedure. So the next time Mr. Rikers called on George to get Deutsche Bank on the telex, I went to the calculator
and put into the machine 1 divided by 4.172.
Note that I omitted the fourth digit, the 1 following the number 2. I did not know what it would be. I knew that the rate was roughly 4.1720, but did not know the exact rate in that particular moment. Now, let's say that in that particular situation, George told Mr. Rikers that the rate quoted by Deutsche Bank was 4.1728. Now, all I had to do was put in the number 8.
Because I had entered in advance the preceding numbers 4.172.
So I put in the number 8 and pressed the divide button. Immediately, the machine began to calculate, which took about 5 seconds. The calculator was electric and took its time, not electronic like today, which produces instant results. So, within 5 seconds, I had the result, i.e., the reciprocal of 4.1728, which is 0.239647. George had just taken the first step towards the calculator, which was 15 yards away. When I said with a loud voice so it could be heard, "Mr. Rikers, the FX rate is 0.239647. At that point, Mr. Rikers gave me a look full of surprise. He might well have forgotten that I was in the room at all, but he certainly now had noticed me. This is an example of how I always looked for a better way of doing things. Social life. While at Citibank New York, of course, I used my time in New York to meet and get to know the traders of OSA banks in New York, just as I had done in Paris when I spent 2 months there the previous year. At that time, personal contacts were extremely important. Those people from OSA banks were exotic contacts for me. I had never met them before, but they were extremely important for future trading after I returned to Germany. Remember, this was 1959, only 14 years after World War II. To them, I also was a rare bird, because there were not that many European traders visiting New York. Some of Mr. Rikers's staff, particularly George de Luna, would sometimes invite Karin and me to their house or their mother's house on Long Island. In particular, I remember the suburb of Garden City on Long Island. It was there that I savved and tasted for the first time food like prime rib of beef, baked Idaho potato, and drinks like gin and tonic or vodka tonic.
Resisting temptation to sell insider information. At those parties, I also met people who were friends of George, but did not work in Citibank. There was one particular guy I remember who made a concrete, devilish proposal to me. He traded foreign exchange at another smaller bank and wanted to get some insider information from me. For example, Volkswagen exported cars from Germany to the USA. The cars were sold in America for dollars. But Volkswagen USA had to pay for the imports in marks. Therefore, periodically, Volkswagen USA had to sell dollars and buy marks to pay for the German imports. These were very large amounts which would move the dollar/mark market rate down for the dollar and up for the mark. This particular guy knew that I sat right there in Eddie Riker's FX trading room and could hear and see when those orders were received from Volkswagen and the transactions occurred. He basically proposed that I would let him know of those situations so that he could front-run it. This means he would buy the marks and sell the dollars before Eddie Riker's would do it, and in this way make a sure profit. In exchange, he offered me a substantial amount of money for providing him with that advance and inside information. The offer was tempting,
but fortunately I did not fall for it. Maybe I listened to my inner voice, and I remembered the poem from my mother's high school reading book, already quoted earlier in this book, but worth repeating here. Good advice. First of all, my child, be faithful and true. Never let the lie dishonor your mouth. From the beginning of time, the highest value among all people was always to be faithful and true. You are still young. It is not yet so hard. But a boy becomes a man. A fledgling bends, but the tree no longer does. Say yes or no, and don't twist your words around. Whatever you say, keep it brief and simple. What you vowed be your highest duty. Let your word be holy, therefore do not waste it. With great ease, the lie sneaks up to your heart. First a dwarf, a giant later. However, your conscience shows the enemy to you, and a voice inside you screams, "Be thou awake!" Then be alert and fight. There is an enemy ready. The lie in you, it threatens you. My dear child, always fight courageously for the truth. You, my child, be brave, faithful, and true. I highlighted the fourth verse because that is the important message. George and other Citibank people also discussed various economic issues with me. For example, at that time in 1959, there were initial discussions about creating some kind of European Free Trade Area, EFTA, which was actually established on May 3, 1960. Those people wanted my views about the pros and cons of such a development. Beginning important friendship with Eddie Rikers. I am mentioning all of that because even though Mr. Rikers never talked to me directly, he must have received good feedback from his staff about me and had begun to like me. On my last day in his office, a Friday, he came back from lunch and approached the area where I sat. "Doing anything tonight?" he asked. I said, "No, sir." And he said, "Stick around, I'll buy you a beer." This was major, and of course I stuck around and waited for Mr. Rikers that evening. We started drinking Heineken beer in the Wall Street area, and as the pubs closed, we moved more and more uptown. We talked about all kinds of things, including our mutual childhood stories. When it was near midnight, he delivered me to a subway station that would bring me to 242nd Street. Just before I turned the final corner inside the station, I looked and waved at him again, and he yelled, "Don't forget, you have a friend over here." My wife Karin had a chance to explore New York for a couple of weeks before she went back home to Germany, again on a Stinnes freighter. She handled all of that alone, and a compliment her for that.
1 week in Toronto and Montreal before going home. As I was already in New York, Stinnes had arranged for me to visit the major FX trading banks in Canada as well. My new friend, Eddie Rikers, phones the respective head traders and probably told them that I was a likable guy. I spent a couple of days in Toronto and then went on to Montreal. I stayed at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Montreal and remember being homesick on my last evenings there. There was a big party in the ballroom to which I had no access. But I watched the action a little from the door and remember an elegant female singer leaning over a piano and singing the song, "My Happiness." Where the skies are grey or blue, any place on earth will do. Just as long as I'm with you, my happiness. From Montreal, I took a Lufthansa Super Constellation plane home. It was still a propeller plane and had to make a scheduled refueling stop in Shannon, Ireland,
because it could not make it non-stop back to Germany. This was in October 1959, just weeks before the first Boeing 707 jet was introduced. That plane cut the travel time almost in half and was much quieter and did not vibrate as much. Stinnes FX dealing room after my return from New York. When I returned to Germany and the Stinnes dealing room, the climate there had changed substantially. Cocky was back in favor with the leadership of the international department, and Dr. Haas and I were not loved anymore. Cold reception, no longer fun to walk at Stinnes. Cocky and his friends felt that I should have declined to go to New York. They said if I had not gone, Stinnes would have been forced to send Cocky anyway in order to save face with Citibank. Everybody also hated Dr. Haas because sending me had been his idea. The atmosphere was very political, and for the first time, it was actually not fun to walk at Stinnes. At the beginning of 1960, participants had to be nominated to attend the third international Forex meeting to be held in early May in Stockholm. I had attended the previous meeting in London in 1959. However, in spite of my many contacts in the international market, particularly in Paris and New York, Stinnes did not nominate me. My new Citibank friend Eddie Rikus comes to Germany. Meanwhile, I talked every day to Eddie Rikus, who was disappointed when I told him that I would not be coming to Stockholm. Eddie surprised me by advising that he would come to Düsseldorf on May 11th to have dinner with me. I will fly into Frankfurt and come up to Düsseldorf by Schnellzug, by express train. He liked to flash some corners of his German language skills like this. I told him that May 11th was my birthday, and if he wanted to dine with me on that day, he would have to come to Mülheim and have dinner at my apartment. He accepted my invitation, and we began to make plans to receive this high-powered American banker at my third-floor apartment on 10 Leineweberstrasse in Mülheim. Dinner at my house on my 24th birthday, May 11th, 1960. Dr. Haas was very excited when he heard that Eddie Rikus would come to dinner at my home. He made his bank car and driver available to pick Eddie up at the railroad station in Düsseldorf, take him to my place, and later take him to his Düsseldorf hotel. At that time, my wife Karin was 5 months pregnant with our baby, Heinz. Nevertheless, she cooked a delicious meal, including the famous German white asparagus, which it turned out was one of Eddie's favorite vegetables. I also had plenty of fabulous German white wine to go with the meal. They had a feast, and overall, a very good time. After dinner, Eddie lit one of his huge cigars, and we continued to drink wine. Eddie offers me a job at New Citibank branch in Frankfurt. Suddenly, at a time when Eddie no longer took his cigar out of his mouth when he talked, he suddenly said, "Heinz, have you ever thought about leaving the Stinnes Bank?" I was quite surprised and said, "No." "Well," he said, "if you ever do think about that, please talk to me first."